This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Steve Senske, CEO of the American Soybean Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. American sugar production supports over 151,000 jobs and contributes more than $23 billion in annual economic activity. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with ASA's Steve Senske next. American sugar beet and sugarcane farmers help keep grocery store shelves stocked with sugar, an American-made all-natural ingredient. American sugar production supports more than 151,000 jobs and contributes more than $23 billion in annual economic activity. Family farming legacies, American manufacturing jobs, and our national food security need strong farm and trade policies. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Soybean growers face a new crop year with a number of headwinds, including high input costs, low market prices, an uncertain export outlook, and questions on government incentives for renewable fuel. ASA CEO Steve Senske says delegates affirmed priorities for the year ahead at their recent policy sessions during Commodity Classic in San Antonio.
The key priorities for ASA right now are, of course, bringing biofuels over the finish line for bio-based diesel, and that means finalizing the RVOs at very robust levels. Number two would be trying to smooth out and make sure that we're not only opening up new trade opportunities, which the administration has been pursuing, but also protecting and stabilizing the markets that we have, and that includes the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, as well as, of course, our trade with China and other countries. And then third is what can we do to try to address the rising input costs that producers are facing? They're caught in a real cost-price squeeze right now.
It seems much of the future of soybean profitability is tied to trade and is tied to renewable fuel. And both of those are really out of your hands.
I would say yes. I mean, farmers don't have direct control. We at the American Soybean Association don't have direct control, but we have a big influence. And that's what we're, you know, working every day to try to make sure that we can bring home the strong renewable fuel policies. I mean, we had advocated and pressed the EPA to propose very robust renewable volume obligations for bio-based diesel, so that means biodiesel and renewable diesel. We saw them propose basically a 60% increase over what the previous RVOs were for bio-based diesel. Those were the proposed levels. We also saw them propose to only offer 50% credit on the RIN value for imported fuels or imported feedstocks. So that really gives a preference to domestic biofuels, strongly in favor of that. And then the third component of that is reallocating any small refinery exemptions that are given out. You know, there's always going to be some refineries that are claiming economic hardship that they can't comply with the RFS. EPA and the Department of Energy evaluate them. But what we're saying is when you do exempt and give those small refinery exemptions out, those should be reallocated to other refiners so that you don't lose the volume of biofuels that's supposed to be blended into our fuel supply.
I guess the best question is, if you get those numbers, what has to happen in order for that to correlate to demand for soybeans?
Yeah, I think if we get those numbers, you're going to see both we have a lot of capacity in the biodiesel plants and in renewable diesel plants that are either idle right now or running on low capacity, low volumes, just because of the uncertainty on the policy. And I think if those volumes are finalized as proposed or close to proposed, I think we will see those plants immediately start up. That means that they're going to be using, you know, more domestic feedstocks like soybean oil in their plants. You're going to see the price of soybean oil rise. That will drive up the price of soybeans. That's going to make crush expansion more profitable, too. You know, we've had historic expansion in soybean crush capacity in this country over the last 5 years. I mean, we've expanded about 20%, close to 25% over the last 5 years. We have a few plants that are still under construction and will be coming online. So I'm confident that we're going to be able to meet the volumes if they are finalized. And it will be incentives to further expand that domestic crush capacity. And that's a good thing for soybean farmers and for our country, because it means, of course, construction in the United States. It means rural jobs in the United States and in rural economies. And it means that those crush plants are there close to production. It improves basis levels. We're not dependent on, you know, foreign importers to foreign trade to for that demand. And it's good for our livestock industry as well, because the more beans that we crush domestically and use the oil for biofuels, what are we going to do with all that soybean meal? It means that it's probably going to be cheaper, and it's going to be great for our poultry, our swine, and other livestock industry.
When I talked to the renewable fuels producers of the country, they wanted to have an adequate supply of feedstocks to produce. But from a producer standpoint, was it not frustrating to see used cooking oil coming in and seeing tax breaks and no real definition for what that UCO was?
Yes, we saw, you know, absolutely historic volumes of supposed used cooking oil coming to this country, as well as like Brazilian beef tallow coming into the country in because of the previous tax credit. Was provided, and they were able to take advantage of that. And because of some of the low carbon fuel policies of some states like California that assign a very low carbon intensity value to use cooking oil or Brazilian beef tallow, basically zero, it really incentivized the importation of that. We at the American Soybean Association worked very hard, and this was in the One Big Beautiful Bill, to say as we look to extend the tax credit, we need to try to limit that to domestic feedstocks, or at least just North American feedstocks. A lot of folks said good luck with that, said that's nice, ASA, good on you for trying to work on that. But we did work with our champions in Congress, and we were successful in doing that. So the tax credit is now under 45Z, is only available to North American feedstocks. That means that we can still import those. We're not saying, no, we're going to embargo you, but we're not going to give you a hug and a kiss from the American taxpayer with the tax credit when you come across the border.
What else is in the 45Z that is of benefit for the renewable diesel, biodiesel industry?
The other big aspect that was in the 45Z tax credit and a reform that we made, too, the other big achievement that we're very proud of that was made there was eliminating from the scoring calculations for the value of the tax credit under 45Z the indirect land use change score. And that is a arbitrary, you know, score that's been assigned to say, you know, as we increase demand for feedstocks, does that increase production, destruction of the rainforest, whether it's in, you know, Indonesia or Brazil. And they've assigned that when, even though it's our domestic program. And so we said that that's inappropriate. And so we were successful once again in working with Congress to have that calculation eliminated. The net effect of that is that effectively doubled the value of the 45Z tax credit for both biodiesel and renewable diesel. For biodiesel, from, you know, roughly 30 cents to 60 cents a gallon.
If I talk to corn farmers, they would definitively say that making E15 sales annually available would help demand for corn and would increase the price. If these RVO numbers come to fruition, can you say that these RVO numbers will equate to better returns for soybean farmers?
Yes, I can say that, and believe that very strongly, that if we are able to pull those proposals over the finish line, and the Trump administration finalizes them as proposed or very close to proposed, that is going to drive demand, and that will increase prices, and it's going to be good for the economy, and it's going to be good for farmers.
If E15 legislation is approved, that's law. But the regulations for RVO and the tax policy is still subject to change. Do you fear changing administrations may change the outlook and ultimately deter those who are willing to invest in this industry from making those capital commitments? Or will the demand, once it's available, fuel growth in the market?
We hope that it will fuel growth. Of course, we would like to have longer-term stability. Anytime anyone's making an investment, they want to know what is the time horizon that I have to make that investment and try to get a return on that investment. The RVOs that are waiting to be finalized now, that are at OMB now, are going to be for calendar year 26 and 27, so that's good for the next 2 years. Then you have to propose. But I think the beauty of it is once you have those higher RVO numbers announced and we demonstrate our ability to meet them, that becomes the new floor. That becomes a new floor for the setting of the next RVOs for 28 and 29. It's really important to have those higher volumes. Yes, there's always the possibility they could go down, but I think once you demonstrate that we can produce and people make the investments, I think it's very hard to lower them. So I think it's a stair-step process.
If you have the supply, will the demand follow, or do you have to grow the demand to increase the supply to make it happen?
And I think that we have demonstrated that in the U.S. Soy industry. Again, historic investment in crush capacity, of expanding crush capacity by a fourth over the last several years. That's never been done before, but that was in response to the demand for biofuels. And I think the crushing industry, if we get robust numbers, they're going to continue to invest. And as you have that increased investment in crush capacity, we're crushing more beans that we produce here at home. And it also sends a signal to the market to produce more beans. Farmers will, of course, are going to go to produce more of the crop that earns the highest return for them.
So renewable diesel, biodiesel, sustainable aviation fuel. Are these three elements the pathway to a new paradigm for U.S. soy?
I think the domestic demand through biofuels is a key part of that pathway. I don't think we can have a new paradigm or have profitability and success without that. I don't want to discount the importance of trade, though. We're still exporting over 50% of what we produce. The international markets are still extremely important to the soybean industry, and there's still growth around the world. I mean, we have 97% of the world's population that lives outside the United States. Rising incomes means that one of the first places they're going to spend their increased income is to improve their diet, and that means more meat and more cooking oil in their diets. And, of course, how are they going to either they're going to import that meat from the United States or they're going to produce part of it domestically, and they're going to need soybeans as well as feed grains in order to do that.
So still on the subject of renewable fuels, at your delegate meeting at Commodity Classic, did you make a statement toward E15? A lot of your soybean growers raise corn as well, hoping for both RVOs and E15. But as a soy industry individually, are you opposed to E15?
Absolutely not. And in fact, our delegates reaffirmed our policy that we support year-round E15. They just have said we don't want it to come to the at the expense of bio-based diesel. I think, unfortunately, some of the in the petroleum industry and the small refiners and medium-sized refiners, they think that they have the fuel industry, the ethanol industry, the corn industry, maybe over a barrel, that they want E15 so bad that they're willing to agree to almost anything. And we want to make sure that we don't agree to almost anything, because what has been proposed by these small refiners and medium-sized refiners is to have to permanently lock in automatic small refinery exemptions that could not be reallocated to others. And what does that do? It means that your renewable volume obligations that have been announced really don't mean that. They're going to be permanently undermined by hundreds of millions of gallons of small refinery exemptions. And so we've said, and we've communicated with the lawmakers that are working on the E15 deal along with our corn and ethanol partners, and they certainly understand this. They don't want that either. That can't happen. So it's not, we strongly support E15, year-round E15, but it can't be at any price. We need to make sure that whatever policy is adopted benefits both corn and soybean farmers.
A chorus of agriculture groups calling on Congress to approve a new farm bill, a farm bill 2.0. What was left out of budget reconciliation that farmers still need today?
There's some really important aspects in there, including one of them that we've been very keen on, very strong about the importance of this, are the provisions of what's known as the Ag Labeling Uniformity Act. Mm-hmm. That means that when the EPA makes a health and safety decision on that a pesticide is safe or what kind of warnings need to be on the label, that has preeminence. And you can't have states that are adopting their own standards, labels, making their own determinations. We have gold standard science from the EPA that makes these determinations. They take years to make those determinations, mm-hmm. and they look at lots of studies and data in order to do that. We can't have states that decide that are spurred on by either activists or trial lawyers or others that say, well, we don't like this pesticide, and we think that you should have a health or safety warning on there. Or the fact that you didn't have a health or safety warning on there, even though the EPA said it was safe, we're going to sue you for failure to warn. And that has the potential to really be used against any crop protection tool, any pesticide out there. And what that means is that, of course, the manufacturers of those pesticides could be driven out of business or stop making them, and that takes tools away from farmers, or it certainly increases the cost of the tools as well.
I recall the time that the soybean industry followed studies suggesting the health benefits of soy in the diet. Now you have the Maha Commission that has come along suggesting beef tallow over vegetable oils. Do you think Maha's getting it right on vegetable oils?
I don't. You know, I think in the second Maha report, they did not, directly take any swipes at seed oils. And so that was an improvement over the first report. And that was based on, we did share with them a lot of that information. I do think that there's a lot of education and they have to take a hard look at that. There's the beliefs and then there's science. And as you rightly point out, there's been, really good science over decades that have taken a look at seed oils and have found that actually, consumers, individuals consuming more seed oils in their diets in place of animal fats like butter or lard actually improves your health outcome. It significantly reduces your chance of heart attack, of coronary heart disease, cancer, stroke, and death.
The dietary guidelines suggest whole foods. They suggest more protein. Seeing more protein in the diet inadvertently, I would believe, is a benefit for soy.
It absolutely is. And, I think that's one of the positive aspects that we saw coming out of the dietary guidelines report is, again, the importance of protein. And that protein can be in the form of, lean meat that's coming from our livestock customers. That's great news. They're our best customers. The livestock industry is. We've talked about the importance of biofuels. We've talked about exports. But the livestock industry here in our country is our number one customer. And to the extent that we have the dietary guidelines lifting up the importance of protein and meat in the diet, that's a good thing for soybean farmers because, of course, what are those animals going to eat? They need feed that is rich in protein, and that's very good for soybean farmers. The second aspect of that is not only meat, but also I think they did call out the importance of protein from plant-based sources as well. So, alternative vegetable protein using mm-hmm. soy-based protein products is also a good thing. So that aspect of the dietary guidelines we were very, very supportive of and cheered on.
The Trump administration has been very active with tariffs, and the Supreme Court has weighed in, and the president is coming up with alternate means on tariffs. How does the Soybean Association view his use of tariffs, and what are the things that you hope for in the end game?
We have not been big supporters of tariffs, so we felt the brunts of course, the tariffs that were placed on China and Chinese retaliation, where they quit buying our soybeans. The biggest soybean importer in the world that normally, you know, takes about between a fourth and a third of our soybean production stopped buying from us. And so we were very active in urging the president to get a deal on soybeans with China. We're very thankful that he did. And that has restarted and our soybean exports to China, 12 million metric tons this year, 25 million metric tons for the next 3 years after that. And that's all very, very positive. We also recognize that, you know, the tariffs and the threat of tariffs have allowed the president and the U.S. Trade Representative to negotiate some very beneficial trade agreements as well with other countries, these agreements on reciprocal trade with a number of countries around the world. But we also think that we need stability on the trade front. And a big thing that we're pushing right now is we need to make sure that we're renewing and keeping in place the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA. We need to address, if we need to tweak any provisions, let's do that. That agreement and keeping that stability in trade, we don't need to have tariffs between our three countries. We need to keep that in place. Mexico, as it happens, is our number two export market destination for U.S. soybeans after China. Canada is our number four meal market. We need to maintain that trade. We've also called on the trade front. We've called on the administration. Initially, it was to refrain from reimposing tariffs on agriculture inputs. Now we're pivoting to calling for exemptions. The administration has listened and has exempted most fertilizer products from tariffs. We now need to exempt pesticides, pesticide ingredients, seed, machinery parts, and machinery from those tariffs as well.
How did your delegates speak to the issue of the increased cost of input?
It's always a big area of discussion, and we do have policy, you know, favoring, make sure that we have robust competition in the industry. We want any kind of mergers and acquisitions to be closely reviewed by the Department of Justice. You know, we are in favor of Senator Grassley's bill for USDA to really study competition in the fertilizer industry, because we've seen, you know, a lot of consolidation there over the years. We've seen a lot of much higher prices on fertilizers. You know, we recognize that some of that is influenced by global events, the, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and other things like that. But we've also seen, we wonder about the competition and whether that's robust enough in the fertilizer industry. And so that's something that we're very supportive of, that legislation, and we have policy supporting that. We also have policy that's supporting of not having tariffs on agriculture inputs. North Dakota State University has been tracking the impacts there, and their study, when they came out initially of taking a look after all the Liberation Day tariffs that were imposed, and said that the impacts on a trade-weighted basis, it increased the cost of agriculture inputs. So you're talking fertilizer, seed, machinery, parts, pesticides, on average, a little over 12%. Through some of the agreements on reciprocal trade that we've had, that was reduced down to about 9%. After now the imposition of the 15% Section 122 tariffs, that's probably going to go back up again. We're probably going to be in the 11 to 12% impact area. And so a 10% increase in price because of tariffs means something. But importantly, what they also found, a couple of things. One is during the first 9 months alone that these tariffs were in place, so February through October of 2025, basically it collected about almost $1 billion in tariff revenue. And that $1 billion is going to be paid by someone, and unfortunately it's farmers. But what they also found is that in some cases, the impact on the farmer was actually greater than the tariff itself, meaning that companies chose to take advantage of the tariffs to raise prices even more than the cost of the tariffs.
Steve Sinski, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of an open mic. It's coming off of the Commodity Classic and the delegate session. It's clear to have a direction from your leaders, and looking forward to what can be accomplished in the soybean industry and what might still be accomplished in an election year in Washington. It is open mic, and Steve, today you got the last word.
Well, I just want to say thank you for being here, and thanks for being a big part of Commodity Classic, emceeing not only the general session, but also, of course, our ASA awards celebration, and you did a great job there, and appreciate that. And just appreciate the job that you do every day to tell U.S. agriculture story and keeping farmers informed of the work that we're doing every day from the American Soybean Association and other groups to try to push and advance the policies that are going to make a difference for U.S. soybean farmers. And that's what we're dedicated to working on every day, and we're going to keep on pushing to make soybean farmers and all of agriculture more successful.
Our thanks to Steve Sinski, CEO of the American Soybean Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. American sugar production supports over 151,000 jobs and contributes more than $23 billion in annual economic activity. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.